and welcome to MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. Another new feature of the fall 2010 curriculum is an international media studies minor here at MTSU, and it involves anthropology courses and the study of media across various cultures. It's a sort of a collaborative effort with Mass Comm and Foreign Languages and Literatures, and we're talking about it today with Dr. Richard Pace, who is a professor of anthropology here at MTSU. Thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Where did the idea come from?
Well, the idea for the international media minor was basically an idea between Dr. Spires and myself. We had been talking for a number of years about interest in international and cross-cultural approaches.
That's Dr. Bob Spires in electronic media communication.
Yes. And as we talked more and more about this, because Mass Comm, of course, has a number of international initiatives, in anthropology, we're also beginning to get very interested in media. We're sort of a latecomer to this approach. But we talked about it and decided, hey, why not have a minor that it's interdisciplinary, that joins sort of the strengths of the different disciplines. So we got to work, got a number of courses together, and presented that to the curriculum committees all the way up to the university and got the minor approved. From my own personal background, I've been doing research in the Brazilian Amazon since 1981 in a little community called Gurupá, which is a peasant community, basically rubber tappers. And I'd been looking at the introduction of television in that community since that time period. I was actually working with a joint project from the University of Michigan looking at TV introduction throughout the Brazil, and I was doing the Amazon part. And so I've had a long-term interest in what media does, in this sense, television, as it is introduced into a new culture. And we were, you know, looking at how people respond, how they interpret, how they refashion, how they make sense of these different messages, whether they're domestic or international. So I brought that background with me and worked with people in Mass Comm to put together this minor.
This would also bring to bear on studies about what few have been done about the internet, the great globalizing force, and the impact of that kind of media. Do you intend to get into also social networking and that kind of thing?
Yeah, when we say the international media, we're talking about everything from radio, TV, movies, all the way to graffiti to fan mail, and including the internet, cell phones, you name it. And the internet is a great place looking at what's happening cross-culturally. In the little community I studied, for example, in Gurupá in the Amazon, they just got the internet. And so it's a great study to look at what they're doing with this as it evolves and how they're going to use social media in a very different context. So all that will be covered in the courses and looking at the different impacts cross-culturally, because the internet will be used very differently in different contexts, different cultures.
How do cultures that previously were not very technologically astute or who have come to technological advances more slowly than other cultures respond to it when they're first introduced to it? Are they eager to jump in? Are they afraid of it? Do they fear that it's more Western than it is or attempt at Western hegemony, that kind of thing?
Probably all of the above are correct. You have so many different responses from different parts of the world. You'll have some that embrace it and immediately use it within their own cultural context. We see that with video, for example. Many indigenous groups will take it and record their cultural heritage or certain political messages like preservation of land or lifestyles, and then spread that around to the other indigenous communities. The Inuit or Eskimo, for example, do that, Australian Aborigines. Even the Kayapo, which is an indigenous group in the Amazon, very effective in using new forms of media to basically for cultural survival. Other groups will be resistant, not want to see the impact of media from outside, especially people resist sometimes Western media and see it as interfering in their own cultural values. So you get all kinds of different responses. In the study I've been doing in the Amazon, I looked at how all those play out wrote an article where I looked at how people heed TV's messages, as well as how they miss them, resist them, and ignore them. And all those are in play in terms of new media as it's introduced to people.
It sounds like this minor also has the potential to examine the political aspect of media, how people respond to media in totalitarian states versus media in democracies versus media in oligarchies and that sort of thing.
Yeah, we are very much interested in sort of the ideological messages of media, and that's regardless of your political system, media will be used by the nation state to try to basically create good citizens. It's not always successful, and it's not always done in a real systematic way, but those activities always go on, and so the ideology of media is something very important. We have in anthropology just recently an interest in journalism, looking at the culture variation of journalism, and basically looking at stories in journalism as narratives that are being told, but within very clear-cut cultural limitations, and those include political as well, simply how you tell it, what's involved, how the resolution occurs. And so there's always this going on in terms of the ideology, the discourse that's going on in media and journalism, for example, is a classic example.
There was something that happened during the Winter Olympics in Vancouver that was very interesting, and it came to my mind when I started reading the International Media Studies minor brochure. There were actually two incidents within the ice dancing competition that caused controversy. There was a couple whose intention was to dance dressed in what they consider to be Aboriginal costuming, and Aboriginal groups in Australia found this to be terribly offensive, and they were asked to alter their costume, and they had leaves and flesh-toned suits and painted faces and all kinds of things, and when they actually came time to perform, they hadn't altered their costume very much, but the Olympic Committee apparently found it to be acceptable. This is sort of it was a place where internationalism and the form of expression that dance is, or ice dancing is, and sport and culture all sort of came together and crashed in the middle of the intersection.
This is something that, again, we're very interested in this minor. It's how people represent others and how others represent themselves. And this is a classic example of how, in this case, the West wants to represent the non-West using certain stereotypes that, as you see, was offensive to the people. When they were putting together this costume, I'm sure they didn't consult anybody from these cultures. They simply used Western patterns of what we assume they are and how they behave and how they dress and live and think, and made a stereotypical presentation, which was offensive. When we do cross-cultural media studies, we look at that, critique it, but we also like to look at how others depict themselves. So there's from photography to film to music, you name it, how people represent themselves is very different, and that sort of becomes very good in terms of creating contrasts. We say in anthropology, create contrast, generate information, new cultural knowledge.
There, the other incident that happened in the ice dancing competition that reminded me of this minor was the one in which the brother and sister team from Israel did sort of a dirty dancing routine to the music from Schindler's List, which Jewish people in diaspora found to be offensive. What happens when someone from within a culture does something through media or expression that insults people not across cultures, as much as it insults people within a culture, within their own culture?
Well, of course, that happens all the time in the United States. You have programs that they're put on that are offensive to certain groups, and each country deals with that one way or the other in terms of censorship or not censorship, or simply if it's more consumer-based, who watches, who doesn't, who advertises, who does not advertise. And so it's an interesting thing how within a culture these ideas will vary. So, that's something else we're interested in within a culture variation versus cross-culture variation as well.
What about advertising? Are other cultures as seemingly inundated with advertising as we are in the United States? And do other cultures use sex to sell products as much as we do?
Well, you have, again, it depends what type of media you're using. If it's commercial and you're basically selling time to basically advertise products, And again, it depends on the culture as well. You can have all those or you can have none of them. Brazil, for example, their advertising goes far beyond what's usually considered appropriate in the United States. For example, on television, they do media or product placement where they actually will, in the storyline, have different products. We do that in the United States, but in Brazil, they'll just do it to the extreme where you'd be walking, two people will be talking, and they pass by a bank sign, and if the bank's giving money for the program, advertising, then the camera go off the people and focus on the bank for, you know, a couple of seconds, then move back to the people. Mm-hmm. And so it's very obvious what they're doing. And in Brazil, of course, they'll use sex to sell products as well, especially during Carnival when, you know, the big celebration before Lent when everybody sort of goes wild and topsy-turvy. Those images are actually used throughout the year to sell a variety of products.
Mm-hmm. Do people in non-Western cultures feel that the Western industrialized nations are trying to change them through media, are trying to impose a sort of Western worldview upon their own culture?
Again, different countries and different peoples within the country have different views. That is a very common view that has been displayed around the world. We call it cultural imperialism. It actually was that idea came from the French, who were more worried about American culture in France. And the third world, it's sometimes used is a rallying point against outside intrusions. Oftentimes it has a lot of internal domestic policies and conflicts tied into it, sort of blame the outsider. At the same time, for example, where I do my research again with TV, I've watched many times people watch American programs, and they sometimes pick up, sometimes they don't. So a lot of times the sort of the nationalistic message or the culture imperialism message that might come through Western media simply is lost by the people, or they simply reinterpret it, subvert the meaning, and come up with something completely different than any producer had thought about. And this is what's really fantastic about looking doing cross-cultural media is all the different ways that media goes awry. It doesn't come out with the same type of ideas that the producers thought. But this is just really common and sort of the rule instead of the exception when you go cross-culturally.
It's interesting that so many American television programs, I mean, going back to Dallas and even before that, Bonanza, they've been exported to other countries and dubbed into all kinds of different languages and have been very popular. I understand that the Law and Order programs are popular in Britain and other things, but in this country where we might see movies from other countries on television, we won't see television programs from other countries on television unless they are from Canada or made in Canada. You wouldn't see a Japanese television program with English dubbing or English subtitles, for example.
In many non-Western cultures as well, other countries, the same will happen once they have enough of their own domestically produced products. The problem is if you don't have enough in your own language, if your industry is not producing as much material, then you import and you dub. In Brazil, again, with the audience I look at, they will watch American stuff, and they like American movies and some of the series. But once the Brazilian productions, particularly the telenovelas, the soap operas, which are really high quality in Latin America, once those are in production and accessible, that's what people watch because it's culturally appropriate to them.
On Univision and Telemundo.
Well, in Brazil, they have their own networks, but yeah. That would be the equivalent that you could find in sort of Mexico and up in the United States. And so culturally appropriate is very important, and people will watch their own stuff when they get a chance. There are other things, though, that will occasionally be created in hybrid, like Survivor or some of the reality shows are easy to basically create in your own language in your own studios. So those go cross-culturally. And even in the United States, we will accept other programs and other cultures, but usually we make them, like The Office was a British sitcom. And so that's sort of our pattern. We make them in our own language, our own culture relative situation, which will be done in other cultures around the world if they have the finances, they have the money, and it becomes culturally appropriate at that point.
Game shows seem to translate well as to Jeopardy is popular around the world, The Price is Right, things like that. But if the other countries were able to produce enough product to transmit to the United States, that would be lucrative for them to do so. Would our American culture accept it? Would we be able to get over ourselves and our pride in being American long enough to try to understand the plot twists and various twists and turns? Or would the producers from other countries try to put an American spin on what they're producing and make it more adaptable to our taste, our mores, whatever?
Probably at this point, since we have such, you know, such a large media industry, there's not a whole lot of space for programs coming in that aren't translated, aren't culturally relevant. And so we're still stuck with, you know, taking their ideas and refashion. Like Ugly Betty was a novella that came out of Mexico. And so we'll do that because we have the finances, we have the ability to transform those shows that come up from other parts of the world. I would mention, not so much in the United States, but Brazilian telenovelas, their soap operas, have been translated and exported from Israel to Italy, some even to Japan. So there is a growing market for some of these non-Western productions in other parts of the world. Not that they have made the biggest impact in the United States, but that does occur. And people talk about the reverse flow, the reverse culture imperialism as a alternative paradigm for the old ideas that it's all going to be American media dominating the world. And these are sort of counterpoints to how, no, this can be reversed very quickly.
Let's turn to film right now. I mean, Hollywood movies are made anymore with an eye before it even gets to the set, before even one bit of film is shot, with an eye toward making money off the international market, either in terms of casting or plot twists or you know, marketing at any rate, whatever. Then at the Academy Awards, Slumdog Millionaire takes the Oscar for Best Picture one year, but I haven't seen that result in a dynamic growth of Bollywood movies in the United States. What's going on culturally with cinema?
Well, you have different genres of film that will compete in different ways, and Bollywood has some very, very fine films. Of course, they follow sort of the cultural patterns that have developed in India. They will be exported. Many other cultures will take them and consume them. In Brazil, you'll find them, for example. Whether or not they break into the American market or when they will, of course, that just depends. And like I said, again, it has to do with consumers and the wealth that they bring to the media, as well as the amount of media that's culturally appropriate in our own culture in the United States. We have lots of movies. And so to break into our market, you have to have a really good film and compete against all this other stuff that already isn't existing in American media. So down the road, for sure, it could. It just depends on changing economics, changing availability, changing demand. But those are fun things to look at and see what will happen in the future.
You mentioned graffiti. How does graffiti play into this? Different. We look at it as expressions of gang dominance on the sides of subway cars, as opposed to art anymore. How do other cultures view it differently?
Well, there's even in the United States, there's graffiti as sort of tags for gangs, and then there's graffiti as art and street art. And so you have these different approaches. But in many cultures around the world, you'll have sort of popular culture and ways of expressing yourself. In Northern Ireland, during some of the height of their problems, they would paint whole buildings with murals of political messages, which were very important, and people would look at those and get a lot of messages from them, a lot of identity. In Brazil, for example, they have certain areas where the street artists will go out and you know, create works of art that are very relevant for expressing sort of political and cultural ideals. So all that varies from place to place. And so within the International Media Studies minor, if we're looking at something like graffiti, we look at how it is perceived, how it is produced, and how it's consumed in all these different contexts. And that's what, you know, makes a very interesting study, this variation.
When I was a kid, I saw if I saw a painting on an exterior wall, it was usually some sort of commercial logo for a product or service or something like that. But I didn't see any murals. We were told as little kids that if we draw on the wall, mommy will spank, you know, so we're not exactly encouraged to engage in that kind of art form. And now it seems that the murals, exterior murals on the sides of buildings as artworks have grown in popularity in recent years, not necessarily graffiti, but actually as paintings, as panoramic scenarios, if you will. What is responsible for that?
I'm not quite sure in the United States exactly. A lot of it, because much of it you'll see in terms of neighborhoods, urban neighborhoods. Sometimes it has to do with culture identity. It's an alternative media to express what you important in your life without going through some of the more other forms, outlets that are dominated by other groups with more affluence and more wealth. So some of it's popular, some of it's protest, and it's, again, sort of what are we as Americans? What are our variations? What are our particular backgrounds? I would imagine it's a way of expressing that.
Okay. What are some of the other areas that you delve into in here? Talk about journalism for one moment. I mean, not just the interpretation of news around the world into various languages, but mindsets of journalists in different cultures as they approach their tasks, concepts of objectivity and differences in professional ethics, that kind of thing.
Yeah, this is a really fertile ground for discussion cross-culturally. Even within the United States, there are different ideas of what journalism is and can and cannot be. You have sort of the CNN approach where it's supposed to be just the facts, unbiased approach. From social science, we've always had a problem with the idea that there can be an unbiased approach, because any reporting, any narrative, any storytelling will have to be within some kind of culture context, and that will also be within a political context. You can see these as news over time, how they shift in terms of what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, what's considered liberal, what's considered conservative. All these things shift over the time. And in media, cross-cultural media, we want to look at that. In anthropology in particular, there's a growing awareness that some of what journalists do and some of what cultural anthropologists do in terms of their ethnographic research has an overlap. We are looking at society, we are looking at problems, we're looking at ways of telling stories about people. And so there is a connection there, actually. I went to school where several of the people went into journalism with their PhDs in anthropology. And so there's a growing idea of this connection. In fact, we have for our profession, we have a monthly newsletter, and this last time it's called Anthropology News, was all about the connection between journalism and anthropology, and how the two can help one another, how they can critique one another and strengthen one another. So there's a growing idea of how the two can interrelate and lead to better understanding. And of course, you know, you have a lot of this came out with the coverage of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. You have different nationalities, different networks across the globe, really looking at it and completely stark differences. Just in Brazil, once again, when I was down there during the Iraq war, they didn't censor any of the images coming out of the war. So you had the blood and guts, what we had in Vietnam, which we did not have this time around. Well, they showed that. And of course, that leads to a very different interpretation of what the war is and who's being harmed and what's going on. So these are important sort of ideological, political approaches, different ways of talking about the news that are important to understand from social science, mass comm, anthropology. And so, again, journalism becomes very cultural, very political, very ideological when you put it within this context.
Western journalists know that if they are in a country like Iraq, they have to use, or Afghanistan, they have to use local individuals to help them to act as sort of quasi half translator, half liaison type individuals, because they know that by their appearance, people will understand that they are not locals, they are not natives, and that by hiring locals, it helps them integrate themselves into the culture more, or to be able to obtain information that they otherwise would not be able to obtain. Al Jazeera English is a channel that I have wanted to watch for some time, just because I want to get that window into the Arab world that that you don't really see in the United States, as journalists, even the major networks, have more and more decreased their international reporting, shut down bureaus in cities overseas. And of course, you can get it in New York, you can get it in Washington, but I think a lot of cable and satellite outlets are still afraid of it. Why are they afraid to offer it as a choice? If I want to pay for it, even as a premium channel, shouldn't that be my choice? I'm not going to buy everything that I see on it whole hog any more than I'd buy anything I'd see in any other medium whole hog.
Yeah, this can be understood on various levels. Of course, we're talking about commercial TV, so your point would be, if I want to consume it, why wouldn't you let me consume it? Part of it may be that there wouldn't be enough of a market there. That might be one answer when you get outside sort of the large media centers. The other issue is the idea of what media does in terms of interacting and controlling thought. We have sort of the old theories of cultural industry, where the idea that you can have a media produced by a nation state and basically one-sided approach that will then will feed to the viewers, the listeners, and basically form their opinions. This was sort of the old ideas. Started with, you know, Nazi Germany and sort of the fear of what propaganda, mass media could be used in terms of propaganda. And of course, that's been one idea all along. And this really comes down to an argument over passive or active audiences, which is a big thing within mass comm and media in general. Does the media tell you what to think? Does it form your opinions? Or do our audiences active? They can reconfigure, rethink, refashion, and accept or reject the messages. And so the idea that if you want to see these alternative messages that could be radically different from what sort of the storyline is coming out of the United States, while you might be blocked from that, well, that might be some of that, maybe not on the government level, but in terms of the different providers for those services, that they might be seen as basically disseminating propaganda that's harmful. So very political, that type of decision, if that's sort of the line of thought that's being used.
Is there more of a taste for or more of a desire on the part of media consumers in other countries to reach out for international news, international reporting, simply because they happen to share the continent with several countries, whereas our country shares the continent with only two countries with whom we've had mostly excellent relations and no fear of invasion? The BBC comes to mind as being the supreme news agency when it comes to international news in the English language, for example.
Yeah, some of that has to do with the sort of colonial past, where the British were when they expanded out through the colonial world. So they have ties there, and they've had sort of a tradition of trying to figure out what was going on in their colonies. And so you'll have people that will look to the BBC in many parts of the world to try and understand what's going on. But just as many people will resist and say, well, that's the propaganda line of the First World, at least of the Brits and this old colonial empire. So you'll get mixed audiences always with these. Some look for it as a source of alternative information. Others seeing it as just another attempt by outsiders to create, redesign a world that's in their interest and in their favor without the local truths coming out. So, again, you'll have all these different responses.
Are there particular kinds of majors here at MTSU that you think would be more interested in the international media studies minor than others? It's open to any student.
Yeah, it's open to anybody. Of course, we'll have people from mass comm hopefully sign up, anthropology, sociology, some of the humanities might be interested. We have some foreign language courses, but people in political science might be interested, sociology, we said. It could be all kinds of different walks of life that people might want to look into, all these different types of media and how it impacts people across the globe. So it's designed to be as wide open as possible, no really prerequisites, just get in and understand culture, understand media, understand the world. That's sort of the goal.
And if people want to know more about the minor, who do they contact and how?
Yeah, I'm the advisor, so they can contact me, Richard Pace, at my emails, rpace@mtsu.edu. So just get in touch with me, and I'll give them more information.
Dr. Richard Pace, Professor of Anthropology at MTSU, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join me again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can catch the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com. And we're available on iTunes.